cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine, plus global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Tim, I got to say, it was another crazy week, another volatile week. And then we had that hot inflation print that had us all thinking, is it peak or is it not peak?
Yeah, that's the question that remains. And we have a great group of people to help really break down and help us find some answers, starting with legendary investor Alan Patricoff from Greycroft. Carol, look, it's fair to say that he's seen a cycle or two, right? Early investor
gosh,
in
yes.
Apple. So he knows what's up with markets like this.
And he had an interesting perspective on some of the tech sell-off that we've seen in some of those well-known names. Plus, we're going to get a good check on the consumer, the CEO of Tapestry, talking about our company's latest earnings. Little hint, they've been raising prices.
All of that to come. We begin, though, with a Bloomberg Big Take this week and this week's issue of Bloomberg Business Week. It's an incredible piece to view online. It's interactive. It's really well told visually. So I encourage everybody to check it out. It's all about exploring Japan's front lines. It's where for millions of Japanese, the confrontation between the U.S. and China, it's already a reality.
Here to explain, Bloomberg Business Week editor Jill Weber, along with Matt Campbell, who's Asia editor for Business Week.
It's actually a series of islands. And what's interesting, I think Americans would probably be most familiar with Okinawa, which is one of them. And this series of islands, you end up closer to Shanghai and mainland China than to Tokyo, which is pretty incredible when you see it on a map. And I do recommend reading it online because the immersive experience that we built for this story is pretty incredible. And what's interesting is obviously the tensions between U.S. and China have been palpable and, if anything, have been simmering and during the Trump administration escalated. And this is like a little quiet area that's right next to Taiwan. As we've been talking about Ukraine and the tensions there, obviously a lot of Taiwan interest has been piqued, I think. And what's really interesting about these islands is, you know, there's this demographic crisis in Japan. Don't have enough workers. A lot of the workers that they would have on these islands have traditionally come from China. And obviously with zero COVID, China has not had that. That means there's no tourism dollars coming from China as well. And obviously there's this huge American military presence there, which makes all of this really interesting because this is a front line, right? Even though there isn't an active conflict, that doesn't mean that there isn't tension and that it's all rooted right in this place. And it has some really interesting and fascinating domestic implications for Japan and geopolitics and even American foreign policy. So Matt, what was the initial thing that sparked your interest about what Yoshi set out to tell in this story?
Well, I always look for what I call small stories that tell big stories, of ways to go to one place or one company or one series of events and then go from there into a better understanding of big mega trends. And what's cool about this story is Yoshi, a fabulous reporter in Japan who put this together, was he found the series of communities in Japan which are struggling with the exact same problem that Japan as a whole has, which is, on the one hand, economic dependence on China, and in fact growing economic dependence on China, but a deepening security alliance with the U.S., and obviously there's a contradiction there.
Well, and, you know, if part of what I have to say as I was reading through, it was really stark for me, and where you said, or where he said, you know, should a war come between the U.S. and China, basically, an unlikely but increasingly plausible scenario because of what's going on in Ukraine. Like, I don't even, I mean, I do think about it, but not, and I feel like you realize, okay, how vulnerable or what, how this might play out ultimately, Matt.
Well, indeed. And Japan, something that is very apparent if you go back in the history a little bit, is Japan is deeply involved in the Taiwan issue.
Right.
Taiwan was a Japanese colony from 1895 until 1945. Actually, in Taiwan, there are somewhat fonder feelings about Japan than there are in many parts of Asia. Japanese governments have said in various terms that they view the security of Taiwan as a strategic interest. So if things really kick off, Japan will absolutely be part of the story.
What's happening militarily on the islands?
Well, there are two things happening. One is Japan is an increasingly strong military power. Military spending in Japan has increased dramatically over the last decade or two and will continue to do so. And the other thing is, as the U.S. pivots more of its security strategy toward containing China, a huge amount of that investment ends up in Japan overall, and particularly in places like Okinawa, which has something like 70 U.S. military bases on one island, if you can imagine that. So really, this is the front line of geopolitical conflict.
Yeah, one of the things that interests me about the story was it's a parallel with Germany, which obviously Germany has had no military spending since World War II. Now it's established that it will be a big presence. One of the surprising elements to me about this is Japan was sort of in a similar role, except that spending has increased, as has its alliance in the U.S. So, Matt, how has that played out domestically in recent years in Japan?
Well, so Japan, under its post-war constitution, which was actually drafted by the U.S. military, has a clause that says, in as many words, Japan will not have armed forces. That has never really been observed. It's always, in the post-war era, had a military. That military is now growing increasingly well-funded, increasingly oriented toward containing China in very forceful ways, should the need arise.
That was Bloomberg's Matt Campbell, along with Businessweek editor Joel Weber.
Coming up, Coach, Kate Spade, Stuart Weitzman. You've heard of those brands, right?
Yeah, I have.
All right. Well, they are all under the Tapestry umbrella, and they weighed in with their latest quarterly update and also talked about the outlook.
We're going to get an update from Tapestry's CEO. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Tapestry, you know the brand well. They own Coach, Kate Spade, and Stuart Weitzman. They came out with their quarterly update this week. They talked about prices, they talked about the outlook, and they also talked about China.
Yeah, and we got to check in with the company's CEO, Joanne Crevoiserat. She joined us to give us her take on earnings season and really help us understand the health of the American consumer,
right,
and the global consumer.
Right, so important to our economy.
What we're seeing in our business is strength and momentum across our business. As you mentioned, our third quarter outperformed, led by strength in North America, and we drove double-digit global sales growth across all of our brands at Coach, at Kate Spade, and at Stuart Weitzman. And, you know, Tapestry is a powerful combination of iconic brands that offer tremendous value for consumers, and we have a platform that we've transformed to drive innovation and customer engagement. And that model is delivering results. We're seeing that in the strength of our digital business, increased customer acquisition, and pricing power across brands. So a lot of things are working and performing, and it really reflects the strategies that we've put in place over the last few years. to stay closer to our consumers and drive growth behind our powerful brands.
Joanne, we want to dig deeper into that, but let me ask you, if you had to describe the consumer in a word or a few words, how would you do it? And would you say that the consumer is back at pre-pandemic levels or maybe even better or still a little bit under it?
Yeah, the consumer is quite resilient. You know, we've been driving growth above pre-pandemic levels for several quarters. And, you know, that's most apparent at our Coach brand, where mm-hmm. we've had more quarters in a row, but also true at Kate Spade and at Stuart Weitzman. And, you know, our business in the third quarter reflects really the strength and momentum we're seeing around the world. You know, we talked about our growth in North America. We drove 22% growth in North America in the last quarter. But we also saw strength around the world in all areas except for China. So we saw strength in Europe. And strong growth in rest of Asia as well as in Japan. So business is performing. In fact, even in China going into the quarter, we saw strength and that business only started to weaken when we saw the disruption related to COVID in the market towards the end of the quarter.
Joanne, I want to hit on the China point and dig into that a little bit, because you had to have, in North America, you overcame pandemic-related weakness in China when you look at the results overall. But I'm wondering from a planning perspective how you're thinking about how long these lockdowns last and how long you're going to see that weakness in China, where business has just dried up since this resurgence of COVID.
Yeah, the business was disrupted, but it was disrupted in a very discrete way, by the impact of COVID in the market. And, you know, our business has been quite resilient over the last 2 years. As I said, you know, we've been driving growth above pre-pandemic levels for some time. And that shows the resilience of our model and the way that we're able to shift to changes that we're seeing in demand and changes in the supply chain and supply around the world. And our latest disruption has been in China. But as I mentioned, we had strength in the market, and we've been driving strength. As China mm-hmm. came out of the first round of lockdowns, the consumer was incredibly resilient.
Joanne, there's so much stress out there, it feels like, certainly when we watch the financial markets, right? And we look at some individual names, even though your stock's rallying, it's down about 25% this year, but it's broad-based selling. It feels like no market or sector is immune, it certainly seems, in the stock sell-off. You sound pretty calm, and you sound, I don't know, is it cautiously optimistic? Help me understand fundamentally what the outlook looks like that might, you know, I think we're all trying to figure out what is the outlook amid a rising rate environment and what is the business environment and what's the market environment? Because you seem pretty calm.
Yeah, well, and we are optimistic. We're very confident. You know, we have such iconic brands in our portfolio, and our focus has been on, you know, restoring the health of our brands and driving better and stronger engagement with consumers. And when we do that, the business performs. So we're really focused on fundamentals. And you know, when we talk about transformation, actually, I heard you discussing investment mm-hmm. in the business in the show just prior to when I came on. You know, we're investing in digital tools and innovation and technology that's making us better. And as we focus on the fundamentals, we're seeing traction. We're engaging customers. We're acquiring more customers. We acquired 1.4 million customers in the last quarter alone. And since we've embarked on our transformation, we've acquired 13 million new customers to our brands over the last 21 months. And these are customers who are coming in and engaging with our brands. They're shopping at higher AUR, higher prices than average, and they're coming back more frequently. And these customers are also increasingly younger. So as we focus on the fundamentals of our business, it gives us confidence because we're seeing much stronger engagement, much healthier brands, and much stronger engagement with our consumers.
Joanne, I'm wondering about your pricing power, because you said that these customers are paying more than they were paying earlier. How much of that has to do with inflation? Where are you seeing a rise in costs right now on your production end and in your supply chain? And how much are you absorbing of that versus passing it along to the customer? Because as Neil Saunders, an analyst with Global Data, said in a note after your results, the customers that you have at Tapestry can cope better with inflationary impacts than the average customer.
Yeah, and the way we think about our pricing power is really in terms of delivering value to consumers. And that's how we've been thinking about it. In fact, we started this pre-pandemic, before we started to see pressure on the cost side of the equation, and those pressures are real. We're seeing pressure on the cost side of the equation like others in the industry. A lot of pressure in freight related to the supply chain dislocations that we're seeing. But our focus really on the pricing side of it and the pricing power is really driven by the value we're delivering to consumers. And those emotional connections that we're developing are allowing us to drive pricing power. And we're seeing that across our brands. You know, some of the investments we've made and tools and technology are helping us leverage data better in across our value chain. So that's making us more informed on pricing decisions. It's also making us more informed on our assortment decisions and our inventory management. So we've got the right inventory. We're seeing higher SKU productivity with more concentration behind more powerful items, and that allows us to drive pricing power as well and to clarify our messages with consumers. So on the value side of the equation, we continue to deliver unbeatable value for our consumers across all of our brands. And that's helping us more than offset the pricing pressure that we're seeing in terms of cost, in terms of our expectations going forward.
That was Joanne Crevoiserat, the CEO of Tapestry.
Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, measuring and tracking how we watch, where we watch, media and apps, a company that does it all.
Increasingly important, Carol, because now we're talking about ads with Disney Plus and, of course, with Netflix. We're going to be joined by the president of TV Squared by Innovid on the changing patterns of how we consume media.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stiefel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stiefel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing. The passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
All right, so how we view and listen to media, right? Like, I don't even know how you're doing it right now. Are you on your phone right now listening to us? Are you on Bloomberg Radio?
You're listening through TuneIn on Sonos.
Exactly, right? There's so many different ways. There's many options. And increasingly, all of this is converging. And our next guest gets that big time.
It's Joe Kinsella, president of TV Squared by Innovid. This is a global measurement and attribution platform for converged TV. Essentially, it means that it measures audiences in a media world that's coming together right now. So people who consume media via different platforms like smart TV and set-top boxes.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. It's great to be here.
Well, I just want to get your takes before we get right into the analytics here. I just want to get your take on the streaming environment, because we did see that Disney beat expectations when it came for Disney Plus subscribers, shares moving higher in the after hours. Different story than Netflix. And I'm just wondering how you would characterize the environment right now, because it's interesting, like this incumbent Disney that Netflix disrupted. Now Netflix is on the other side of that, with shares down, you know, more than 75% from its highs last year.
Yeah, AVOD is definitely the cool kid. So I think, you know, Netflix held out as long as it could. And, you know, they held off from bringing ads in for the longest time. And then we saw the fluctuations with the share price. And here we are. I have not had any early indication as to what the Netflix offering is going to be. But, you know, thinking that it's probably going to be the same as or similar to what everyone else is doing. But you asked me, Tim, you know, to describe the streaming world right now. I think I can use a very nice British term, which is bonkers. And, you know, the latest statistics that we're seeing, because TV Squared by Innovid actually measures linear and streaming, but streaming is actually now accounting for, according to the IAB, about $21.2 billion worth of TV inventory. So it's really, we've seen this massive transformation and shift to CTV during COVID.
Help me out though, a number alone doesn't always give me perspective. So 21.2 billion in TV inventory, what percentage is that in terms of streaming?
Look at it this way, Carol. It's a $70 billion universe in the US. It's about 200 billion globally, so it's small. I would say, mm-hmm. if you look at local television, so you think about local broadcast, local cable in the US,
right.
that is also 22 billion. And think about how old that kind of industry has been in existence, you know, thinking about the cable companies and everything else. So if you think that CTV is now the same size as local broadcast and local cable, it's really come from nowhere. And at the end of the day, everybody is now watching TV in such a different way that we're going to continue to see this huge growth in CTV.
Joe, how does the technology at TV Squared by Innovid work? Because when you talk about the streaming landscape, it's really fractured in terms of the end user and how the end user gets that signal. Could be on a Roku, it could be on an Amazon Fire Stick, it could be on a smart TV by LG or Sony. So the data is really disparate. And I'm wondering what technology you have to be able to provide companies that are looking for this data with accurate info.
Yeah, it's a great question. And one that we've tried to solve, Tim, in software. We believe that the only way that you can solve for the challenges of the modern day advertiser is to be global and to have a solution that is software based that truly scales. And that's easy to say, but it's actually harder to do. What's been amazing about the recent acquisition by Innovid is that we've basically been able to kind of superpower our measurement, which is, think about it this way. Innovid has a ad server that delivers ads for the 40% of the top 200 advertisers. What does that mean? That means about a billion ads a day. And it means that we can take every impression that gets served and pump it straight into TV Squared and either map it to, like, who did I reach? What was the audience demo? And did they take an action? So I want you to think of this as we've done the hard bit. We've done the stitching together of all of these different platforms. And because Innovid actually delivers the ad, we can see if it's a show that runs on Peacock, on a Roku device, on a Samsung TV, we can still see that impression. Therefore, for us, what's beautiful is there's no walled gardens and we're independent. So if you're an advertiser,
right.
everyone's calling us saying, hey, wait a second, you can see all the way through the customer journey what happened.
That's Joe Kinsella, the president of TV Squared by Innovid.
You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. More to come. You know the name, venture capitalist Alan Patricoff. He checked in with us about today's market volatility as well as opportunity. He's had a career that spans 50 years. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, with all the market volatility again this week, I mean, it's really been the theme of 2022, market volatility. So we recently caught up with a perfect guest to talk about it. He has seen a lot of market cycles.
Fair to call him legendary, Alan mm-hmm. Patricoff, an early VC. He helped build and grow such companies as America Online, Office Depot, a little company called Apple, Audible as well. He's the chairman emeritus and co-founder of Greycroft. He's also got a new book out, Carol. It's called No Red Lights, Reflections on Life, 50 Years in Venture Capital, and Never Driving Alone.
You know, everybody I meet has lived for such a short time relatively in this market that they only see everything going up. And I've lived through so many cycles that to me, this was inevitable. It's going to come. Everybody was living in a euphoric state that things were only going to go up. And I think you better be prepared for some kind of hiccup. And I don't know why it's going to happen, but that's just the way the markets work.
How big of a hiccup and how long of a hiccup?
Well, I think it depends on what the afterfall is after the this initial setback. You know, will the market stabilize or is it going to, you know, after a certain period of time, go down again? I mean, the levels that the market's at has just been increasing steadily until the beginning of this year. I mean, last year was dramatic. The whole Trump era was dramatic. I always follow the theory that markets don't like surprises. And all we had was surprises for 4 years. And the market kept going up. So I think we've got an after effect of that. And I just say one thing, this is not the time to sell. I think you got to ride the rocky periods and watch how and see how it stabilizes.
Even a name like, you know, you've got Meta, Meta platforms, right? You know, Facebook down about 38% this year. We were talking about Netflix before we got going. It's down almost 46% since April 19th when it just freaked out the markets, right? When it came down with a lack of subscriber growth. So I don't know, how do we make sense of some of that? Is that opportunity to you, or is it like there's something wrong?
Well, if I were following public markets, I'd be looking very carefully for where the opportunities are in terms of companies that have relatively good values in relation to their revenues and their profits, and which ones have the balance sheets that are going to sustain themselves no matter what happens to interest rates. But in terms of Meta and Google and Apple, I think we're going through a period where finally the Congress are now focused on the monopoly positions that these companies have, and there's legislation pending, and I think that it's long been in company. You realize that the internet has not had any regulation. There's been no regulation in 25 years. We're living with outdated monopoly laws, and I think that Europe has just passed some very significant laws, and the U.S. is going to follow, I think, very shortly, and that is an overhang.
Very curious about your thoughts on this. Does the monopoly power that you argue that some of these big tech companies have, to what extent does that stifle innovation when it comes to startups?
Of course it does. I mean, you know, I can't tell you the number of companies I've been on the board of where I've gone to a board meeting and they'd say, traffic was down 50% or 20, whatever the percentage is. Why Google changed their algorithms?
Yeah.
I mean, that's monopoly if I've ever heard it. I mean, our original monopoly laws were related to control of the railroads, the control of oil. Now we're seeing a different kind of monopoly control, and that is, you know, when you have 90% of your search going through one vehicle, and when people are putting their own internal products and offerings ahead of other products that are available, that's monopoly.
Consumers get hurt.
Yeah. Ultimately, of course they are. Well, let's put it this way. The advertisers are getting hurt. The competitive businesses are getting hurt. And I think everybody is mesmerized by, you know, one-day delivery and getting low prices. But at the same time, it's hurting a lot of small businesses.
Elon Musk and Twitter. What do you think about that?
It worries me. One person, this is the major social media communication platform. All of us, maybe not all of us, but a lot of us certainly use it. And to have one person, and this will be a private company also,
right.
I think it's, again, another element that I would be concerned about. And I think it's also going to be subject to whatever potential government regulation. I mean, he hasn't gone through this process yet. I think that we still may see some headwinds that may slow this down or prevent it. I don't think it's good for society.
So talk to us about this book. We were reminding you, we talked about this, that when you were on last with us, which was a few months ago. You actually leaked that you were coming out with a new book. So why did you write this?
Yeah, I mean, I've been asked for a long time to write a book because I've been in the business. You know, by being in a business 50 years, you become first you're the father of venture capital, then you're the grandfather of venture capital, then it's the legendary Alan Patrikov. So, you know, being a legend, I wrote it because for two reasons. One was I thought it might be valuable and why I gave the title No Red Lights, I've lived a multidimensional life, and I feel that that's a valuable idea to convey to younger people about don't get lost in your own, you know, small world. Be open to opportunities and get involved in politics, get involved in charities, get involved in art. And I've done all of these things, and there's not much that I haven't been involved in or that I'm not open to. And I live a very active, multidimensional life and always have. I thought that spirit would be valuable to convey. Plus, I saw what was happening to older people who are, you know, kind of checking out because of retirement ages being forced on them at 60, or they've sold their company and they go to Florida and they start playing golf. And I was saying, as I started my first company at 36, my second company at 72, and 2 years ago I decided to start Primetime Partners at 85. And I thought that I wanted to be a poster child. You know, I'm now 87. I thought it would be kind of inspirational. I don't want to, you know, overdo it, but that people who might read it say, listen, if this guy can do it, you know, why can't I do it? Why can't I? Maybe if I only inspire one person to say, you know, I'm going to follow that lead and take on some new challenge, go back in the same business I've been in, only do it all over again.
The subheadline of the book is Reflections on Life, 50 Years in Venture Capital, and Never Driving Alone. What do you mean by never driving alone?
Is that everything in life is cumulative. We don't get where we are by doing things by ourselves. It's I find it's very valuable to always be in partnership with people in whatever you do, and I follow a very collegial approach to everything I've done. And I find it a good practice to be open to meeting new people at all stages. And as I say, life is cumulative, and the people you meet early on in your career, they come back at you again and again. And I can tell you that, which I say in this book, many of the people I met when I was very young in this business are all running some of the major companies in this country, or certainly in this city, but in the country. And I say to everybody, turn to your left and turn to your right. You just don't know where someone's going to end up. And you develop those associations and relationships. And I find that that's been very helpful in my life.
You know, Alan, I think many would argue, you know, certainly coming out of the pandemic, and we just saw the speed of change and innovation pick up so much momentum because companies had to for survival, whether it's digitization or, you know, we talk about digital medicine, like just so many different things and how we shop, just so many things kind of just picked up so much momentum. But there was, many would argue, a lot of innovation during what was a very, very difficult time. And I just wonder, when you have looked at innovators over 50 years, like what is it that stands out from somebody, whether it was an Apple or another company, that you just knew that this was somebody or an institution that was on the cusp of doing something very differently?
Well, you know, no one has that much foresight that they can pick winners all the time, because as part of the business, there are a lot of losers in the process. But you know, what you'd like to find is someone who's got a vision and who's passionate about what they do. And I think that is fundamental to being really successful. I mean, you know, Mark Zuckerberg was a perfect example, who was a passionate person. Sergey and Larry were passionate. Steve Jobs was passionate. I think that if you're driven, that has a lot to do with not just knowing the technology, but have a vision of what you want to do. And one of the things that concerns me is I give a lot of lectures or courses at colleges every now and then. And when you ask people in these business schools, you know, how many of you are going to start a business? You know, three quarters of the class raise their hand, and they have no passion really about what they want to do. They're doing it because someone in the previous class started and made $5 million and sold their company, and they figured, if they did it, why can't I do it? So as a result, they start a new dog watching company or a new delivery company. And so we have a lot of repetition, not as much originality in the startup and innovation as we'd like to, frankly, as I'd like to see. You know, most things today are applications of existing technologies.
That's Graycroft's Alan Patrickoff.
Really well-known venture capitalist and someone who has seen so much. If you missed any of the conversation or want to hear the full conversation, just check out our podcast at Bloomberg.com. And that wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Coming up in our next hour, Baristas Unite, the unionization of Starbucks. It's the cover story in the magazine this week.
Plus well-known chef Danielle Ballou on the state of the restaurant industry.
This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine, plus global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including a look at the state of the restaurant industry, especially in New York City. We'll do that with acclaimed chef Danielle Ballou. He's actually opening up a new restaurant.
Plus, a look at the current edition of Bloomberg Pursuits. We've got art in there. We've got theater in there. We've got music in there, plus the books of the summer.
I love that list. First up this hour, though, we do want to get to the cover story of Bloomberg Business Week. It's on the Starbucks revolution with a push toward unionizing baristas. We caught up with the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber, and the reporter on the story, Josh Idelson.
Joel, I want to start with you because this is the third time that Howard Schultz has been at the helm of Starbucks. What is the Starbucks that he found when he returned just about a month ago as CEO?
The surprise, I think, that probably awaited him was one that he was not probably familiar with from his other stints, which was this newfound power that labor has. And Starbucks, which I found really surprising, the workers of Starbucks have, you know, for all of this talk about unionization sweeping the country right now, Amazon being one that we've talked about extensively, All of those roads lead back to what has been happening at Starbucks. And Starbucks has been really, the workers of Starbucks have been a galvanizing force that a lot of other workers in corporate America have been inspired by. And Josh, to his credit, saw this long ago and started reporting the heck out of it and going to as many states and talking to as many workers who were behind the scenes of that union effort. And so what you really have here is a CEO who helped build this company into a global brand, comes back to it and has found that the workers aren't buying that same vision that he had laid out long ago. And you see this tension between the workers and Schultz. And it even culminates with, you know, the workers being invited to the White House and the company sort of saying, hey, you know, we got cut out of this. So Josh, what do you, you're somebody who follows labor, obviously, very closely. I think Josh is like probably as good as it gets in terms of labor reporting in this country right now. And what really distinguishes the Starbucks story for a wider audience here?
So in recent decades in the United States, it's pretty much unheard of for workers to win a labor board election at a company as prominent as Starbucks, where there isn't a union already and there isn't some kind of deal between the union and the company to play nice. And it is being done mainly through workers mentoring each other, not just workers organizing their coworkers, but workers training other workers to train other workers to train other workers to organize their coworkers. And that is how, as one worker put it, this ultimate group project has spread so quickly and has proven so difficult for Starbucks, despite all the resources at its disposal and the goodwill that it's had to stem this movement from growing and spreading further.
There are a lot of directions I want to go, Josh, but one question that continues to stick out to me is, you know, Starbucks is, as corporate, is very pushing back very aggressively when it comes to these unionization efforts on an individual level, even before Howard Schultz came back. Remember, he flew to Buffalo to meet with those unionizing employees. What is at stake here for Starbucks? If there is widespread unionization across U.S. stores here, to what extent does that affect Starbucks' business?
Well, there are two big reasons that companies tend to resist unionization, and one is money and the other is power. Of course, for the union to prove its worth to workers, it is going to need to show that it can extract things from Starbucks that workers wouldn't otherwise get, and some of those things are going to cost money. But the other reason that companies fight unions and that they often are willing to spend a whole lot of money both on anti-union consultants and on making improvements to try to mollify people is that they don't want to give up that control over how the business is run. And Starbucks for years has bragged, including Howard Schultz has bragged, that there's an empty chair at the board meeting that represents workers' voice. So now you have workers saying, why is the chair empty? Put us in the chair instead. And so for Starbucks to become substantially unionized would mean that Starbucks executives have less unilateral ability to decide what the business model should be, what the rules should be. And that's part of why the stakes here are so high.
Josh, what happened at the company? I thought this was the one where they paid their workers well. They had nice benefits. I mean, this is something that Schultz kind of took pride in, as you report. What happened?
Two different ways. And one is to say it's not as dreamy as it may sound. Even the $15 minimum pay that the workers will be guaranteed by August is not a living wage for someone with a child in a city like Seattle. The staffing issues have been egregious at times, especially during COVID, and the handling of COVID disappointed some workers and left them feeling betrayed. The other answer they would give is that it's not enough to be better than other fast food companies. They believe they should have more say in their working conditions and therefore in their lives, and that there is no one particular thing that Starbucks could solve that would make them go back to being okay with the company having all the control.
And where do things stand with Schultz? Because as you write, this is not a he's not permanently CEO right now, right? He's just back on an interim basis. So where will this dispute go?
That's what they've said. There's supposed to be a permanent announcement in the fall. There are some people hoping that Schultz stays on, but it is a fight that is deeply personal for Howard Schultz.
Coming up, we catch up with the CEO of Brooks on the changing landscape of running shoes and being owned by someone that you might know. We're talking about Berkshire's Warren Buffett.
This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, so he has headed up Brooks Running for more than 20 years, Brooks being a century-old Seattle-based company that makes, as you would guess, running gear.
Yeah, well, if you go back some 20 years ago, this was a company that was tinkering with bankruptcy. Also, one more thing, Carol. It's a subsidiary of the standalone company of Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, along with, you know, other really well-known brands like See's Candies and Dairy Queen.
The journey is all in a book by Brooks Running CEO Jim Weber. His book, Running with Purpose, How Brooks Outpaced Goliath Competitors to Lead the Pack.
You know, I think there's more uncertainty in our world maybe than ever before for business people. And, you know, there's so many things you don't control. And that's such a cliche, but it's just true. So we start with the fact that we're going to have things that we have to navigate that we don't control. And so I think the key for us has been customer focus. And I'll give you one example, Carol. You know, in March 2020, when the pandemic hit, all the lights went off, all retail closed. We had no radar for demand. What was going to happen? And because we were customer focused on the runner, once we saw them starting to run and buy gear, we sort of, you know, hit the gas pedal again. So I think the key for us to navigate all these crazy times is our customer focus on the runner. And it's an advantage I think we have because it's all we do.
Jim, back in 2019, it feels like years ago at this point, you moved or shed much of your presence in China, this according to Reuters, and instead moved a lot of the shoe production to Vietnam. I think that to a lot of people that looks really prescient doing that before COVID even hit. But I'm wondering if that actually managed to help you over the last 2 years, because it's not just China where supply chains are snarled. This is a worldwide issue.
There's no question about it, Tim. And you know, the truth of the matter is that last fall, being in Vietnam, in the south of Vietnam, where many of our key production partners were, was a tough place to be, because for 3 months, almost half of our production capacity did not make one shoe. That was in Q3 last year. And so we're short on inventory now. We're not delivering demand. So I don't think it matters maybe where you are. Of course, the supply chain disruption in transportation and logistics has impacted everyone, no matter what your product is. So yeah, I think it's been super challenging. But you know, given our history, we've been through challenging times before. And so, you know, our team rolled up our sleeves and we just have to roll with, you know, the changes that come forth and do our best to keep our customers informed, and we communicate with our retail partners and runners. You know, we don't have all the product that they are demanding today, but you know, we're doing our best to help them understand why. I would say, though, in the last several months, things have stabilized for us, you know, in our industry, and that, you know, we've been pretty much running at full capacity now for over 4 months. So we're in a more normal mode. If there is such a thing as normal in this supply chain world, you know, we're going with smaller boats to smaller ports. Air freight isn't even affordable anymore. So we've just tried to navigate around, you know, the constraints that are out there in the supply chain right now that we all have to deal with, and costs are up. But, you know, we're focused on the customer. So we're trying to do our best to navigate through that and supply demand.
Well, and in terms of pricing, what kind of pricing pressure or leverage do you have with consumers right now? And just got about 40 seconds, and then we're going to come back, and I promise we're going to talk.
Yeah, I would say we don't feel like we have a lot. Yeah. We've raised prices where we could modestly, I would say. And we don't raise prices every year. So this is the first price increases that I think we've made on our key shoes, the Adrenaline Ghost, in probably 3 or 4 years. So we have raised selectively some prices up. But, you know, we don't think the consumer can bear everything. So we've got to navigate that.
What's the first exposure or interaction with Warren Buffett when he became interested in the company?
Well, it goes back for me. I was reading his annual letters when I started in the business world in the 80s. So I felt like I knew him. But we were owned at the time by Fruit of the Loom, which was a Berkshire Hathaway subsidiary. And we began to sell shoes at the annual meeting expo. And so I sent him a note saying how much fun we had, and we met a lot of shareholders, we sold a lot of shoes, and he said, "Great, if you're ever in Omaha, come by, we'll go have a steak." And so I went to lunch with Warren. We met for 3 hours, and I knew he was going to like the Brooks story, because we're building a brand very uniquely and distinctively. We're a challenger brand in a great category, and it's a great business, and we've been growing at double digit now for literally for 20 years. So I knew he would be intrigued by the story. And it was just a wonderful meeting. And he's a sponge. He's just so curious about anything in business. And that's the conversation, the first one that we had about Brooks.
What about the conversation since? I mean, how would you characterize how much you're in touch with Warren Buffett? I mean, he even himself, in the foreword to your book, writes that Berkshire Hathaway has followed a dramatic hands-off style in its operations, with only 25 employees, while 360,000 employees go about their jobs in the many dozens of individual companies like yours. Yeah, so does he never call you? Like, how often do you talk to him?
I believe Berkshire must be one of the most unique corporate cultures in all the world. I cut my teeth at Pillsbury and in banking and then in building brands like Brooks. But Berkshire is so unique. They never call. In one sense, you know, they've described, they have a very distinct acquisition strategy and investment strategy, looking for great businesses. But once they buy the business, They don't require us to morph our reporting around their needs. They take all of our reporting and the way we want to look at the business, and we share it with them. So they morph to these 100 some different businesses. We don't morph to them. And so the only required we send them are quarterly reports and annual report, much like any public company would do. And the only required conversation is annual comp, frankly. And and they empower us to run the business. We love that. We take full responsibility for everything that happens here, good and bad. And you couldn't ask for a better home if you want to build a brand in. It's wonderful.
It's like our lesson is we're always told, like, if you don't hear from your bosses, that means you're doing your job, and that's good. So it's like it's when there's problems, that's when they come a knocking.
Yeah, and they expect you to manage it and solve those problems. And we know that. So it really works great.
What did you learn in doing this book? Because it sounds like, you know, you obviously, when you came to the company, it was very different. It was, as I mentioned earlier, like on the brink of bankruptcy, a lot of different heads of companies. Tell us about that journey.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons I wrote the book is Brooks is a fantastic challenger brand story. And we're in a great category. It's global and running, and every big platform brand, some of the best brands in the world, from athletic footwear and apparel, from the outdoor industry, from fitness, is doing running gear, shoes, head to toe, and obviously bras and jackets and everything else. So that's where we're competing. But I think in the world, there are more challenger brands than there are leading category platform players. And so I wanted to share the story because I think what we're doing is been a lot of fun, and we're building a great brand and a great company. And hopefully there's other people that are involved in categories. Maybe they're a challenger brand that will get some value out of it.
That's Jim Weber, the CEO of Brooks Running.
Next on our menu, famed chef Danielle Ballou on opening a new restaurant as the New York City restaurant scene opens up as well.
This is Bloomberg.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Our next guest is definitely well known to our Bloomberg Business Week audience and community. I'm guessing some of you have eaten at his establishments as well. We're talking about chef and restaurateur Danielle Ballou, owner of several restaurants in New York City alone. And he's also got restaurants around the world in Singapore, Dubai, also at sea.
Well, the good thing is I see all the spectrum of the market, because I even have retail store like Épicerie Boulou, Restaurant Daniel, Le Pavillon, which is a year old this month. And Daniel is celebrating his 29 years. And of course, Le Gratin being this new restaurant, as well as Bar Boulou, Boulou Sud, that are also casual, more approachable. I think we have been having a very good quarters, and we are entering to our second quarter with very strong, a lot of demand, a lot of private dining as well. People are going out, people are spending, but no more than before. Or if they do, it's because they really wanted to splurge on the missing things they really missed. But we see the lunch coming back. The Midtown business lunch are coming strong. But there's also that blend of business people and social people. People want to gather together and celebrate. And the buildings are filling up more and more. And we see the activity inside. We see also in the amenity floors how many people come for lunch, as much as in the restaurant.
What about when it comes to finding employees? Because we know that's been so difficult for many industries. How are you when it comes to staffing the restaurants?
Well, that is, it is challenging, but we have a lot of young people coming to New York. A lot of people want to move back to New York. Move back or move to New York because they see an opportunity to be part of this sort of new beginning again in New York. And we see a lot of young talent who maybe weren't thinking of it and now are engaging at coming to New York. And we have also a lot of more people, I think, on the job market coming. So it is perfect. No, we are trying to be very careful. It's a balance between the shift we operate and the amount of staff we have in order to guarantee the quality of service and food.
So you've seen a lot of cycles. And I think even after 9/11, right, people were really concerned about downtown New York and parts of New York, and just it came back. And we've seen so many different cycles in this wonderful grand city that is Manhattan and New York City. How would you put this cycle? And kind of do you expect that we get back to kind of the grand levels that we saw pre-pandemic?
I think the worst part of the cycle is almost there. The bad part of this cycle is when the RRF came out and only distributed a third of restaurant a compensation to help them restart their business. Mm-hmm. And more than two-thirds, I would say 1.4 million restaurants never got anything. And so this forced a lot of closure. This forced to so many business to not be able to reopen the business they had. It was impossible. And also, you know, the last 3 years, 2.5 years, the uncalculated amount of loss that restaurant business had. And I hope the government will do something about this very unfair sort of distribution that happened in our business.
Well, we talk a lot about people moving out of New York, and we've also talked a lot about the way that jobs have changed here in terms of remote and people not having to necessarily live in New York City to work here. Do you think New York City ever comes back to levels, at least when it comes to employment, when it comes to the service industry that we saw pre-pandemic?
Of course it will, because I think the transition of the home office situation will still last a couple of years until there's really a settlement of balance between people's life and business necessity. But and I think there is a lot of in our business, the hospitality, if someone say I want to work from home, it's not going to work. You're going to have nobody serving your meal.
Right.
Or cooking your meal.
There are so many strains and stresses still on this industry. And I think about labor, certainly, and labor costs, or just finding the workers you need. But also, Danielle, about just higher food costs. Are you able to pass all of that along to your customers?
We try to be very, very cautious on raising price as much as we get hit every day with a raise of something. I mean, if it's not the lamb, it's the asparagus. If it's not the asparagus, it's the artichokes. Of course, they come. Artichokes come from California. They have to travel all the way to New York. Mm-hmm. And so we get very creative and try to really work with our local suppliers as much as possible.
That's our conversation with Chef Danielle Ballou.
Catch the full conversation. You can find that at businessweek.com and Bloomberg.com. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, what is widely considered the most important art show in the world and its new focus.
This as the spring art auctions get underway, and Carol, they mm-hmm. are getting pricier.
Also getting an assist from Elton John, a dive into the magazine's pursuit section.
That's next. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Every new watch is like a new piece of art. It has a different story to tell.
Italian wines as a whole really speak to that quintessential need.
It is the most powerful car made in the U.S., period.
You get the beautiful interior, the iconic design.
It's very chic and posh.
Even if you pay for it, it's something that money can't get.
It is time for Bloomberg Pursuits, and joining us is arts columnist James Tarmey, who had a lot of work to do because, man, this section is all his.
Nice job, by the way. This is really good. I want to start with your recent trip to Venice for the Biennale.
That's work.
That is absolutely work, and I will continue to insist that it is to whoever questions my forthcoming expenses.
What was it like being there? Because it was the first one in person since the pandemic, right?
Yes, it was actually delayed a year. And I have to say that this was the most triumphantly successful Biennale that I have been to in a decade. It was more art, better art, more people than I have ever seen before. It was a real must-see in a way that I can't overstate.
All right. I had never heard of it, so I'm an idiot. So tell me about this.
Wow.
All I can say is wow.
Listen.
Thank you for admitting that.
Let me give you a brief overview.
That's going to be played over and over in a promo.
Over and over.
So what is this event?
So the Biennale is, as its name implies, an event that occurs usually every 2 years. It was delayed a year because of COVID, but this was the 59th edition of it. And what happens is there's this park on the southern tip of the island called the Giardini. And there are around 30 national pavilions in 30 different countries put on their own contemporary art exhibitions. And it used to be a sort of...
Sounds like an arts world fair, but anyway,
it
go
is.
Ahead.
It is, and it's a way of kind of stating kind of your national identity, but it's also a way of kind of putting forth how progressive and interesting your country is in terms of the way it's a form of soft power, effectively. Mm-hmm. And so then there's, in conjunction with that, there is a colossal exhibition in two parts: one in this massive pavilion in the Giardini, and then the other in the Arsenale, which was the place where Venice, when it was a republic, created its ships. It's a huge shipbuilding factory, and so there's, it's acres of space where you put art in, and then there's also ancillary pavilions in the Arsenale, and then there's literally hundreds of other exhibitions spread throughout the city. It is amazing. And so
how do you see it all?
Well, you need at least 5 days, usually six. I mean, just to go through the main exhibition, which was curated by New York's, I mean, she's Italian, but she's the curator of the High Line, Cecilia Alemani. She curated this time, almost universally lauded, which never happens. Real triumph. But you need all this time to go, because you're walking through the city unless you're very, very rich, and then you have a private boat that you've hired for the week, which
George Clooney and Amal would definitely have their private boat.
It's around 250 euros an hour if you can get one, and they just kind of sit outside whatever exhibition space, and then you get on and it takes you from place to place.
But I mean, if you're spending tens of million dollars on art, then 250 euros an hour is like whatever.
Yes. Unfortunately, I'm not, and I didn't spend that.
Was there a theme or like a takeaway, and maybe how it different from the past?
Yeah. So this is actually what... Thank you for that lead-in, Carol, because this is exactly what I wrote my piece about.
I'm an idiot, but I can usually get people to different places.
I mean, so what's very, very interesting to me, at least, or to anyone who's focused on the art market, is that there is a major preoccupation still with figurative painting, which is, say, painting of people, the human form. And it, in the contemporary market-driven contemporary art market right now, it takes the form of figurative painting of non-white subjects. And this has been extremely popular for, let's say, the last 6 years in the market. I mean, it's been popular for longer kind of outside of that. But it's basically a product of people realizing that non-white, non-male artists had basically been left out of the art historical canon for centuries because of intrinsic biases in institutions and collecting habits and so forth. So everyone sort of rushed to correct this. And the easiest way of demonstrating that they were rushing to correct it is a literal figure of the person who you're collecting. And this Biennale was a major transition away from that. Not in that it was a transition away from collecting or emphasizing identity and the work of non-white, non-male artists, but a move away from figuration. People are saying, okay, well, maybe these people have more things to say about the world than simply that they exist. And so it is, in many respects, a more sophisticated step forward, and it could have major market implications, as the art world can oftentimes dictate the trajectory of the art market.
How did this theme manifest in Gian Maria Tosati's piece that you wrote about?
Yes. So the Italian Pavilion is incredible. It's around 20,000 square feet. And it's this artist, Gian Maria Tosati, as you say, who...
Well said, by the way.
Yes.
Thank you.
I mean,
nice. I practiced.
Really, I still well just said. Trips off the tongue. he sort of had... Could do whatever he wanted, and he created these series of haunting industrial rooms that were empty. So it was like a sweatshop lit by fluorescent lights with sewing machines, just deserted.
It looks freaky.
It is really freaky. And then at the end, you walk into this huge kind of warehouse and out onto this nearly pitch black concrete pier where you then dimly realize that you're surrounded by like black ice cold water. And anyway, so yeah. There's no figuration. It's very, very weird.
So how does this sort of new way, and I don't necessarily want to say it's a new way of doing things, but on a scale like this, how does this translate to the market? Because you can't really buy or transact in an experience like that,
well,
even if you are worth billions of dollars?
So that's a really great question. And there are ways of manifesting conceptual ideas in artistic ways that aren't necessarily experiential. So there are artworks that, I mean, in very, very, very simplistic terms, can be abstract but have conceptual underpinnings. There are artworks which can be figurative and have conceptual underpinnings. There are many different ways that you can create art that people can buy that isn't simply about the artist. And I think that is something that we are increasingly going to be seeing in the years ahead.
I feel like the theme of it, right, will play out in works of art that ultimately people will buy, right? Like this overarching theme.
But it's a little grim, though.
Oh, yeah. It is grim. But, you know, the thing is that some people are grim. Some people are actually kind of optimistic, but everyone's looking to the future. And that was what was a real change from the art market and from years past.
I have no easy segue, but I got to go there because I want to talk about The Devil Wears Prada, the musical, and I want to talk about Elton John. Because you have a story in Pursuits about this.
Yes.
This is wild.
It's going to be, heard it here first, folks. It's going to be a major hit. So it's Elton John collaborated with Shayna Taub, who's a lyricist and a songwriter herself, and an author and a playwright. And she created Suffs, which is right now at the Public Theater, which is like Hamilton-level hype in terms of you just can't get a ticket. Tickets are selling for like $600 over the price. I mean, big, big stuff. Anyway, she collaborated with Elton John to do Devil Wears Prada, the musical. And
the title sounds like it wouldn't be good, but you know it's going to be great.
Well, I certainly hope so. she's a really talented person, and
yeah.
Elton John is Elton John.
Yeah, he does pretty well, right?
He does okay. He does okay. So it's going to be really big. And so the whole thing is them translating the movie, which everyone has very strong feelings about, onto stage and making it feel fresh.
Okay, we only have a couple minutes
left. And they
do
make it fresh, but you're going to have to read it to find out why.
Yes.
I want to talk books here,
yes,
because
please.
It's not too early for us to start thinking about summer reads. You've got some great fiction, some great nonfiction in here. David Sedaris is still spinning yarns.
Yeah, he is.
And he's got a lot of houses. I had no idea he's made so much money.
He's been successful. He's really rich. And frankly, you know, like if you follow his writing, you know, he spent a lot of time at the beginning of his career talking about what it's like to be poor. Now he's just sort of kind of unabashedly describing the Picasso that he bought at Sotheby's.
Which house is he going to put it in, though?
Well, you know, that's a great question, because he did just buy a second apartment in his Upper East Side co-op, I guess, because he didn't want to hear. It's kind of convoluted, but his long-term boyfriend, he calls him his boyfriend, but they've been together for decades.
Hugh is
like learning the piano, or really learning the piano, and one of them didn't want to be around the other when they were practicing, so he just bought another apartment above him so that he could hide. It's stuff like this. But, you know, it's still hilarious. And there are a lot of really good jokes that I cannot tell you on air, but they are phenomenal.
And there's a lot of other books covering so many different topics. Thank you so much. Glad you had a great trip, and I'm glad you shared it with all of us.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. That's our arts columnist, James Tarmy. And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday. It starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast. Check it out on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com, BusinessWeek.com, and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
And you can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take, available at Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Ready to buy some art?
Yeah, if it's, you know, not too expensive.
Budget art?
Yeah, not the stuff that's in Pursuits.
All right, this is Bloomberg.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.